From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, WUWM's Marty Michelson parses the recent primary election for Wisconsin Supreme Court with Marquette Law Professor Ed Filone.
It's going to be a very clearly partisan race. It's going to be clear that Dallet is going to seek the support of Democrats and Scranton is going to seek the support of Republicans. Something similar to the 2016 race.
Then how libraries are evolving to include much more than books, records, and microfiche.
Libraries are really good at diversifying everything that they offer, making sure that they have something for everyone, not just the story time for the little ones, but also, you know, the Lego clubs, the tech and tinker programs where the kids can play with robots.
We get some advice from the Danish on how to be content during a long winter. And we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It'll be Sauk County Judge Michael Skrenick versus Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Rebecca Dallet for Wisconsin Supreme Court in April.
Skrenick placed first in Tuesday's primary. He had 46% of the vote, while Dallet came in second with 36%. Madison attorney Tim Burns was eliminated.
The general election will be held April 3rd to replace Conservative Justice Michael Gableman, who's retiring. Skrenick appeals to conservatives while Dallet drew votes from Democrats.
Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone told WUWM's Marty Michelson that the primary results aren't surprising and it sets up a bitter race come April.
Well, I think that it was a race where the three candidates tried to set out different lanes for themselves. I think Skrenock tried to run the traditional conservative race, saying that he would simply apply the law, benefiting from the independent spending from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and assistance and donations from the Republican Party. Dallet tried to run in the lane as the experienced judge, but also making some references to the political situation we're in and running an ad that was critical of Donald Trump to sort of signal her leanings. Tim Burns ran a very open campaign about his political views, trying to excite the grassroots in the Democratic Party. And we see what happened. The Republicans had nowhere else to go, so they stayed with Skrenock, and the Democrats broke very strongly for Dallet.
What are the key differences between the two candidates that advanced?
Well, I think the key difference is it's going to be a very clearly partisan race. I think it's going to be clear that Dallet is going to seek the support of Democrats and Skrenock is going to seek the support of Republicans. And I think we're going to see something similar to the 2016 race, where you had Rebecca Bradley and Joanne Kloppenburg survive the primary, Joe Donald in third place, not making it through. In that race, you know, Bradley ended up with 52% and Kloppenburg ended up with 47% in a very clear split among the parties. Now here, if you add, if you add Burns' vote and the Dallet vote, then it would indicate that if the Burns supporters turn out for Dallet, that Dallet would have the advantage. There were more votes cast for Burns and Dallet combined than for Skrenock. I'm not sure that Skrenock has the enthusiasm of the Republican base that an incumbent like Rebecca Bradley had. And we'll have to wait and see what happens in the next month and see if the Republicans can gin up that enthusiasm.
How will things unfold between now and April? Do you think we'll see outside spending?
Oh, yes, indeed. I think, well, certainly on Skrenick's side, I think the interest groups, Skrenick did not raise much money himself, and he really just sat back and let independent groups run his ads on TV He may have run his own advertisements a few times. I didn't see any in Milwaukee County. It's possible he ran his own ads elsewhere in the state, but certainly not at a statewide level. But I think the independent money will come in strongly for him because that's what these groups do. And I think Gallet has shown that she can raise money, and it should be, I would think, a very expensive race in the next month.
Do you think it'll get ugly, and do you think it will be a nail-biter in the general election?
Well, I think I would not be surprised to see it get ugly. I think that Dalit has positioned herself as an experienced judge who says that she wants to stay nonpartisan and yet has given enough signals to the Democrats to indicate that she should get their support. I think Scrinock may find, I don't know what they'll look at their, if they have internal polling, Scrinock may find that he has to attack in order to make up some ground. Again, if you take Dalit's right now, the total's not finished, but Dalit's at 37%, Burns is at 17%. You combine those two, 54% ahead of Scrinock's current 45%. That would indicate Scrinock is behind right now, and so the way to make it up is by going negative.
WUWM's Marty Michelson spoke with Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone. You can hear all of our election coverage and more at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, how libraries are evolving to include much more than books, records, and that old standby microfiche. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that right after this on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. February marks Library Lovers Month. Book nerds everywhere rejoice.
Well, actually, Audrey, scratch that, because it isn't just readers who benefit from the services that public libraries provide.
Even in our current digital age, library use is up around the country, thanks to programming that's evolved to meet the needs of all different kinds of community members, particularly students.
Makerspaces, robotics classes, coding groups, and Lego clubs are just a few of the extra offerings for school-age kids within the Bridges Library System. That's a group of 24 public libraries spanning Waukesha and Jefferson counties.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello had a chance to visit one of those programs, the Lego Club at Pewaukee Public Library.
All right, what's the Bricktivity for today? Build a model of something relating to your favorite book.
Oh, I needed that slanted thing.
Oh.
What are you making?
I was gonna make something, but then I didn't want to because it was really hard.
What was it?
It was supposed to be a cat.
Wow, that is ambitious.
But now I'm just gonna do a lightning bolt because it's like for Harry Potter.
You like Harry Potter too?
We're only on the second one.
Who's your favorite character?
Probably Harry Potter and Hermione.
How long have you been doing Lego Club?
I've been doing it for a few months now.
What's your favorite part about it?
I don't really have a favorite part. I just like all of it.
Ooh, what is that?
It's supposed to be a Triceratops. Do you know what that is?
A dinosaur, right?
Yes.
What book is that from?
I don't really know, but I do like dinosaurs, so I know that chances are my favorite book has something to do with the dinosaur.
That's a fair bet. Do you guys do Legos at home too?
Not super often, but yeah.
So when you come here, is it kind of a special treat?
Yeah. It's kind of like you decide what you want to build. It's just they give you kind of a category.
You build something different every time?
Yeah. And the categories change every year.
Do you like that you get to do it at the library?
Yeah. It's a safe place that you can read and check out books.
And do stuff like this?
Yeah.
After Lego Club, Bridges staff members Jill Fuller and Angela Meyer sat down with Rachel to chat more about how today's libraries are evolving to supplement what kids learn in school, as well as to fill in the gaps for things they might not get in the classroom.
When I think about libraries, I remember as a kid going to do summer reading programs, and then like third or fourth grade when school started to get a little tougher, the library was like a once in a while thing. It wasn't as regular as I got older. How do you guys try to keep kids of all ages coming to the library? Is it the programming? Is it making sure that you market the other resources that that library offers? How do you keep kids engaged as the function of the library is different for them?
Right, because they're not coming to story times like they used to, kind of a thing. Well, I would say that the libraries are doing a really good job of not being just a one-stop, you just come for one thing, you leave. Libraries are really good at diversifying everything that they offer, making sure that they have something for everyone, not just the story time for the little ones, but also like, you know, the Lego clubs, the tech and tinker programs where the kids can play with robots and do all sorts of things. It's really looking at what kids need, what kids are interested in, and providing access to that. You know, there's still books, there's still an emphasis on that. There are still book clubs, but it's not a boring book club, it's the manga and anime club. Or it's taking something that a kid is interested in, like robotics or Legos or any other type of thing that the kid is interested in at that time and really running with it and like, okay, you know, we're gonna offer that here. It's about offering opportunities too. Kids get opportunities in school, of course, all the time, but this is just one more way for kids to learn new things, discover new things, have opportunities to do things outside of their normal routine. And so libraries are just really good at recognizing that and then meeting those needs.
There's different ways that libraries market to different communities based on their needs. So for instance, during Lego Club, the parents don't have to stay in the room with the kids because they're of a certain age. So they're free to roam the library and get some books for themselves. So as a parent of an 8 and 10-year-old, I can greatly appreciate that 45 minutes in the library. That's like, you know, supreme me time right there. So I think that's really helpful that libraries have programs for middle-aged kids that they can come to.
When we talk about Lego Club, when you mentioned that to me, Jill, that you guys had that, it automatically made me think of Lego League, which I know exists in schools all around Wisconsin, or robotics, like there are robotics clubs in schools. So in terms of the programming that you offer and the way that you are positioning yourselves to students, are you positioning the library as like a supplement to school, an alternative to school in the cases of schools that might not have some of those programs? How are you positioning yourselves?
I would say that the libraries are offering both. Each library works closely with their schools. That's just a given fact. And every school district is different. Every library is different. Every community is different. So I know of libraries that are doing both depending on, you know, what the needs are. Maquanago is a great example that they work with their local high school, the IT Academy. A couple of the high schoolers actually teach some of the classes in Makerspace to the younger kids. So that's a really great example of actually partnering with the schools, getting the schools to come in and work with the library on those things. And so then those resources are being used. Then, of course, there's other communities where the schools aren't able to offer those things or there is a fee for it, and then the libraries can give that opportunity to the school kids where otherwise they wouldn't have it.
When you're developing new programs, how do you decide what you're going to offer? Is it because something doesn't exist in a school? Is it because it does and you want to add that supplemental program?
I think it largely depends on the library. So each library kind of has, you know, their own patrons, their own communities. So they're assessing those needs, you know, as they go and seeing what the schools are offering, what they're not offering, what the kids need.
For the Girls Coding Club at Maguanago Library, they actually had a parent forum to ask, you know, what do you think of this club? Is this something that you would be interested in? And they had such an overwhelmingly positive response that they decided to start it. So now they're one of our first libraries in the system to have that specific club.
The other thing, too, is that as professionals, you know, we librarians, we're always paying attention to what's new, what's up and coming, what schools are doing and not doing, what things kids are interested in. We have professional development, we have continuing education where we meet speakers, the books that are coming out, the things that kids are interested in. We make sure to pay attention to that so that we can meet those needs, that we can try to bring that in. Libraries have always been, even from the beginning, about offering access to opportunities and materials. And it doesn't matter if that's a book or an ebook or an Ozobot robot. You know, our goal and our mission is to offer access. And so that's what we strive to do, no matter what that might be.
When you mentioned all the programs that you guys have, I was like, oh, is this a, are the programs a way to like keep membership or, you know, visitors up? Right. Or is it because there's so many visitors that have been talking about other things they want out of a library? Because I wonder if there's a misconception that like libraries have always been around and now we have the internet, so why would we need a library? Sure. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe specifically how it relates to students because they have access to so many other resources at schools too?
Bringing people together is really what we're experts at. And really it's building that community piece so that people aren't just stuck in their home using their Wi-Fi or watching Netflix all day. It's coming together and sharing those experiences.
Addressing the, especially for students, you know, and why libraries are still important, there's a lot of misconceptions with that too, I think. You know, school libraries get funding cut, you know. School librarians often aren't retained or they're spread across multiple schools. A lot of times school libraries aren't open the whole time that the school is open. So that's a problem. That's an issue, and not just in Wisconsin, but across the nation. Libraries, you know, we have our doors open until the end of the night, so we're here. And that's very necessary because libraries aren't always available inside the school. The thing about internet use, too, is that not everyone has equal and full access to internet. In the school they do, but once they go home, they have to do homework. Not everyone has that reliable internet access. Actually, almost 20% of Wisconsinites are underserved as far as broadband access. I was actually speaking with someone last year, and she was saying that they live in a rural area in Jefferson County, and she was saying that when her son has to take a test online, they go to the library to do it because their internet is not reliable, and if it shuts off when he's in the middle of a test, it shows that he didn't take it, and he gets, you know, the failing grade. And I think that that's kind of common for a lot of people. I think that's important to understand, too.
In terms of the staff that are employed at all these libraries, as you've added all this programming, have you found that you've had to hire more librarians or different kinds of librarians?
Depends on the size of the library. So in a larger library, such as the Waukesha Public Library, they're going to have a larger children's department staff. So someone might be able to specialize in preschool versus school-age tweens or teens. So they do end up having a specialty where they're serving, and also with collection development, so which books that they're buying for that age group and what kind of programming that they're offering. Overall, every librarian's job includes some kind of programming and outreach. So it's not just about buying books and making sure that you can get a book into a child's hand. I think it's also about meeting those needs for recreational and educational. It's kind of expected that you're able to do that kind of programming as well as hand a kid a book. Mm-hmm.
Especially for the mid-sized to smaller libraries, you've often got just, you know, a few staff members filling all of those roles and doing everything and keeping the library running and filling all of those needs. You've got small libraries that are doing fabulous programming with just a few staff members. So it's one of those things where libraries are increasing what we're doing, but that doesn't always necessarily mean that our budgets are increasing or that our staff is increasing. So that is a challenge for a lot of our libraries, but it's one that we are meeting, a challenge that we're trying to meet and deal with because we're passionate about what we do. We're passionate about getting these, you know, materials and opportunities to kids, to adults, to whoever needs it.
WUWM's education reporter Rachel Morello spoke with Pewaukee Public Librarians Jill Fuller and Angela Myers.
While the Winter Olympics, which is wrapping up this weekend, might represent happiness for some, the Danes have the real scoop on what makes life a little brighter during a long, dark winter. We will learn more about what that is when Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We're into February now in Wisconsin, and if people aren't actually away on beaches in the Caribbean, they're dreaming of the beaches in the Caribbean. It's gray, dark, cold, and, well, let's face it, we just need something to escape to.
Well, Mike Viking of the Happiness Research Institute in Copenhagen has written two books that Wisconsinites might turn to in order to make the best of the Wisconsin winter. One explains the Danish concept of hygge. It's a word that encapsulates the coziness, warmth, and togetherness that Danes seek year-round, but especially in the autumn and winter. The second is The Little Book of Lucca, which explores why Danes consistently rank among the happiest in the world.
Viking begins by talking to Lake Effect's Mayan Silver about the essence of the concept.
So the main ingredients, I would say, is relaxation, togetherness, equality, savoring simple pleasures, and the right lighting. I think that the shorthand for explaining hygge is the art of creating a nice atmosphere. To us, it's a noun, it's an adjective, it's a verb, but it's something that covers all those ingredients.
So one of the statistics in the book, because you have a whole book on hygge. And one of the statistics that struck me was how important hygge is for Danes. You wrote that if you look at Danish, a search for a beautiful restaurant in Danish, you get 7,000 Google hits. Quality restaurant is 9,600 hits. Cheap restaurant is 30,600 hits. But actually, you're going to have to pronounce it hyggelig.
Yes. That's the adjective, yeah.
Yeah, if you're Googling a hyggelig restaurant, which means like a hygge-like restaurant, you'll get 88,900 hits. Can you explain how the Danes are obsessed with this coziness factor, and is this still the case?
So I think you could say it like hygge is to the Danes what freedom is to Americans, something we see as inherently Danish and part of our culture, part of our everyday conversations. And it's just something that comes up a lot and something that we give a lot of value to. So if you invite people over for dinner, let's say I invite you over for Saturday evening, and during the week we'll talk about how hyggelig Saturday is going to be. Then on Saturday we'll talk about how hyggelig it is, and then after you leave, my girlfriend would ask, do you think they had a hyggelig time? And on Monday we'll talk about how hyggelig Saturday was. So I think that's how important hygge is to Danes.
Well, and so what are some of these things that create that atmosphere? Like, what would be in a 2018 hygge emergency kit?
I mean, because atmosphere is what it's all about, then there would be probably candles. Because Danes are obsessed with lighting in general and candles in particular, because the lighting in a room really sort of sets the atmosphere. And Danes, I think the rule of thumb here is we enjoy the lower the temperature, the more hyggelig the lighting in a room. So instead of having a fluorescent light in the ceiling, we would have smaller lamps around the living room, which creates sort of little pools of light and also makes people look nicer. We have a sort of phrase a concept that is called looking grotto fabulous, because if you have a lower lighting in a room, people also looks nicer. So I think that the lighting is important, and that's why in your hygge emergency kit 2018 you would probably find candles, because they give off a light that is softer, warmer, and sort of lower in temperature, and that's also why Danes, when you look at the consumption of candles in Europe, we burn twice as much as number two because of the hygge culture. We actually, at the Happiness Research Institute, we have candles at the office.
And what are some of the other things, like what is the hygge attitude towards food, for instance?
It's basically gimme, gimme, gimme. So I think... you know, everything just becomes better with cake, coffee, candy. I mean, hygge is basically also an excuse to sort of savor simple pleasures in life. It's comfort food, it's long, slowly cooked stews, it's cake, it's everything that is basically forbidden in our modern society. But giving ourselves a break from all the regimes of healthy, clean eating and just, you know, being human for once.
So do all these things sort of come naturally for Danes and they look at people like Americans, for instance, like, why is this not intuitive to you?
So it's been interesting to see how hygge has been embraced now in the past year or so, because it's a Danish phenomenon. It's a key part of our culture and tradition and part of our everyday conversations. And then suddenly I and a few other people write books, and then it becomes a global phenomenon. I think my book is now translated to, I think, 35 languages. And then you hear different sort of stories from readers from around the world. One typical one is that people write me and say, I've been having hygge all my life. I just didn't know there was a word for it. And I think that's really interesting that what we have done is essentially just labeled an activity and something that people were already doing and enjoying, but just gave it a name. But also that's the other aspect. You get a sense of the culture from different journalists by the questions they ask. So a lot of your colleagues in the US will call me and say, you know, what if I only have 15 minutes to hygge? How do I hygge in a fast way? And perhaps they're sort of missing the point, because hygge, you can't rush that. It is about a slow pace. It is about being present. It is about turning the speed volume down a little bit. So that, I think that's interesting to see how it's interpreted in different cultures that way.
So I was wondering, can one experience hygge on their own, and how does the sharing with people factor into this?
Yeah, so it was actually one of the most heated discussions I had with my team when we were researching and writing the book, whether you could hygge by yourself. The majority of us believe that, yes, you can, for sure. But there was one guy who thought that hygge is absolutely about being with other people. And to some extent, he's right. I mean, it is about togetherness, but you can also hygge by yourself. You know, enjoying a good book while drinking some hot chocolate by your window if there's a storm outside would be really hygge-y by yourself. But I think it's also, I mean, I think it reminds me of, this was actually an American student who was in a class I taught when I was doing the book. And I brought hygge up and we talked about it in class. And she said that to her, hygge was a wonderful thing because she is an introvert. And that is also another label that hygge has received, namely socializing for introverts. So because it's a smaller group, because it's about sort of equality and it's not about sort of grabbing the spotlight or sort of a high-powered social networking event, but it would be more like, you know, board games or watching a movie together or just having a sort of everyday pleasant conversation, then it was a social activity that she enjoyed more than she was used to in other settings.
I get that. I'm kind of an extrovert, but I'm getting more introverted as I get older. How does everyday happiness that hygge can bring factor into your overall happiness?
Part of my work is to understand, why are some people happier than others? Why does Denmark often do well in the happiness rankings? And that's also why we started to look at hygge in the first place, because, of course, the sort of Nordic model for countries is of importance. There's a high level of welfare. There's a high level of social security. There is free university education. There's free universal healthcare, and that impacts quality of life tremendously for people. That's why all the Nordic countries are always doing well in the happiness rankings. Basically, it's, you know, everybody in Denmark would vote for Bernie Sanders. I mean, to us, Bernie Sanders, he's not progressive. He's just common sense. So that explains why a lot of the Nordic countries are doing well in the happiness rankings. But we needed to understand, why is it that Denmark often just do a little bit better than the other Nordic countries? And that's why we started to look at elements in our culture. And that's where hygge came in. And hygge is about sort of pursuing happiness or moments of joy on a daily basis. And what we can see in the happiness data is that, no big surprise, if you have an everyday with a lot of positive experiences or positive emotions, that over time also accumulates to higher levels of satisfaction with life, which is typically what is being measured and captured in these happiness rankings.
And, well, besides hygge, Danes seem to get a lot of satisfaction out of biking. Can you tell me what role that plays?
But when we look at the numbers for Copenhagen, the majority of people are commuting to work on bicycles. So students ride the bike to universities. I ride my bike to the Happiness Research Institute. People ride their bike to their offices. And even the majority of our members of parliament ride the bike to what is our parliament. And we do that not because it's good for the environment or because it keeps us fit, which are great, but we do it because it's fast, it's convenient, and it's easy. But it also means that suddenly my mobility is not dependent on how much money I make. And even if I lost my job tomorrow and my savings, I can still get around the same way tomorrow as I do today, because there's been a lot of investment in infrastructure for pedestrians and for cyclists in Copenhagen. And I think that's a little example of how investment in the common good reduces worries, reduces stress, reduces competition and anxiety for its citizens.
Do Danes cycle in the winter too, like all year round?
Yeah, so 70% of Danes continue to cycle throughout winter. But it's also because, I mean, for the city of Copenhagen, it's a priority to cater for the cyclists. So if we have snow, the city will make sure that the cycling paths are cleared for the snow before the car paths or car lanes are. So, I mean, yes, I cycle throughout the year, as do the majority of people in Copenhagen.
Is it getting below freezing where you guys are?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. So
okay.
The coming week, we'll have a couple of degrees Celsius of minus zero. So yeah.
So you guys do need to warm up with some hygge after that.
Yes.
And one of your other points is that since hygge is about indulgence and enjoying things like cakes and candy, that this using biking as transportation can help counteract that, right?
Exactly. So when we look at the numbers of the share of different citizens in Europe who exercise more than 5 hours per week, Danes are at the top of the list. And it's not because we enjoy going to the gym, but it's because exercise is built into our daily transportation. And that is also something that allows us to have a second slice of cake once in a while.
Mike Viking, thank you so much for coming on Lake Effect, and I wish you a hyggeligt evening.
Thank you, and well done using the adjective. Well done. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mike Viking leads the Happiness Research Institute in Denmark, and he's the author of 2 books, the latest of which is called The Little Book of Hygge. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver.
Mayon and Lake Effect intern Claudia Delgadillo spent some time along Wisconsin Avenue trying to learn how Milwaukeeans hygge. They ask people about the things and activities that help them get through a long Wisconsin winter.
Pretty much just hand warmers and boots and gloves, the common stuff they need for winter weather.
Long johns, coffee,
hot cocoa,
jumping around, stay warm.
lot of times I'll go home and I'll actually take a hot shower to just try to get the chill out. I think that always seems to do the trick.
Play with my grandkids.
Watch The Price is Right.
Let's make a deal in Wheel of Fortune.
I even DVR it. I don't miss it.
Oh, yeah, I don't miss it. I DVR it.
Drink.
No, have a couple drinks. Stay home and read a book.
Gotcha, okay.
The fireplace. A wood-burning fireplace is the best, or an outdoor wood-burning fireplace that blows the heat in, that can't beat it. The smell of the wood plus the heat, there's nothing better.
And what about food, you guys? What kind of food gets you through this kind of winter?
Deer. Venison from hunting. Depending on how you get your deer cut up, a deer should be able to last through the winter.
You make stew for that?
Oh, yeah.
Chili.
Yep.
Chili.
Chili's a good one too, yes.
Beef stew is always a good one. Lots of chicken noodle soup. Lots of it.
You were gonna tell Danish people like how to stay cozy in Milwaukee. Like, what would you say?
Don't come. Go somewhere warm. That would be my advice.
They're called countdown days.
Yeah,
countdown days. Put a calendar and you mark down when June's coming, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna go.
I like spring.
But baby, it's cold outside. But baby, it's cold outside. Been hoping.
The voices were Sharon and Debbie from Oak Creek, Barb and Melissa from Racine, Jackie from Whitewater, Diane from Cudahy, Heidi from Tosa, and Tim from Mount Horeb, Terry from Newburgh, and Travis from Milwaukee.
We'll take one last break, and then our storytelling series Ex Fabula comes your way. This is Lake Effect Weekend on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this
No
dream?
Cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew.
Your eyes are like starlight now. I'll take your hat, your hair looks.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is Ex Fabula Radio time once again during Lake Effect Weekend. We do this every weekend at this time. Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney from Ex Fabula usually is here too, but this weekend she's not feeling well and might have the flu. So as we always say around here, if you are sick, stay home. Don't come in and spread around what you might have. So Leah is at home this weekend. Hopefully back next week. National Black History Month is coming to a close next week, so we are sharing stories today from two women from two very different generations who are doing their part to honor their histories as they pave the future for others. First story this afternoon comes from Cantera Sofront, told at the Power, Dissent, and Youth Empowerment event, which was held at the Milwaukee Art Museum in September of last year. This is Cantera Sofront.
So I don't remember when I started feeling like a sub-character in human history, but I think that feeling happened during seemingly innocent moments, like when I opened up a textbook and I didn't see faces that looked like mine reflected back at me. Like when I learned about the Haitian Revolution and I learned nothing about the women who were involved in it and who fought alongside their fathers, brothers, friends, and lovers. Or when I walked through beautiful galleries and I didn't see works of art or artists who looked like me or reflected my ethnicity, my gender, my heritage, or my culture. So I don't remember when I realized that I was a sub-character in human history, but I do remember when I realized that I wasn't alone in that feeling. So when I was around 8 or 10 years old, the Oprah Winfrey Show was on television, right? It was 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and my mom must have been in the kitchen hanging around, and Oprah would be in the background. And I remember on this particular day, the stage was filled with this black family. And I was really excited because this family looked like people who I knew, members of my family. They were black men and women who are various hues, from light skin to cocoa brown. And I felt like, oh, okay, I see them. And they were on stage because they were all descended from Thomas Jefferson. And I remember feeling confused because I'd never heard that story before. And I remember feeling confused about why people were so upset. And I also remember feeling confused about this woman, Sally Hemings, whose name kept being dropped by everyone on the stage, it seemed like, but I had never heard about her. And how could such a woman cause such a commotion? Sally Hemings, whose great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren were now on the stage talking about having been descended from Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. And I remember that the camera would scan the faces of the audience members who looked so darn uncomfortable. Like white people whose jaws were dropped, black people who were shaking their heads knowingly, like, come on, y'all, you knew. And then, and I also remember feeling like there was this tension and this rage over Sally. Like Sally had forced people into this uncomfortable position where they had to talk about slavery, and they had to talk about race, and they had to talk about this woman who may have been loved by Jefferson, but she may have also been the product of multiple assaults. And I remember feeling like Sally didn't really have a say in how her story was told. Sally had three options. She was either passive, she was either violated, or she was forgotten. So maybe it's because I felt like I saw Sally and I understood her, and I understood what those options felt like, that I really committed myself to becoming a cultural historian, to become a person who keeps the history of people who look like me, black women, so that they would never be forgotten or passive or people who are only seen as people who are violated. So when I look at objects, I see their beauty, but I also am looking for reflections of myself, of my own beauty in the object. And so when I went to Chipstone, I went and I got really geeked out at Chipstone, right? And if you haven't been to the Chipstone Day of the Project, you should go, because I felt like when I was in Chipstone, I was in the company of other people who understand that objects tell stories, and who understand that objects are ways of rescuing people from being forgotten, that you could tell the story of an enslaved person who tells his story through pottery, and you can tell the story of a whole nation of people who are from the Congo and maintain their history when they arrive in Georgia. And I remember walking through the Chipstone galleries, and I remember being struck by the Jefferson chair. So if you don't know, Thomas Jefferson actually suffered from really debilitating arthritis. So this chair was specially made for him, and it was the only chair that he could sit in where he felt relief from that debilitating arthritis. And when I saw the chair, I wasn't seeing the chair and seeing our nation's third president. I wasn't seeing the chair and seeing John Hemings, his slave, who made that chair for him. I saw the chair, and I saw Sally. And I went to scream Sally's name in the galleries. I went to keep her from being forgotten. I went to keep her from being someone who was seen as either passive, violated, or forgotten. And so I think about Sally, and I think about myself, and I think about all the women who've been forgotten through history despite all the ways in which they've dissented throughout history. Women like Sally, enslaved woman, mother of six or seven of Jefferson's children. Edmonia Lewis, a woman of Haitian descent, first African American, first Haitian woman, and first Native American woman to receive international acclaim for her art making. Cecile Fatima, Haitian woman, voodoo priestess, sparked the Haitian Revolution. I want to call out these names because I know that their stories aren't my stories, their abuses aren't my abuses, but in calling out their names, I honor them and I keep them from being forgotten. Sally, Edmonia, Cecile, Quintera, seen but not forgotten.
Thank you.
Cantera Sofront telling her story at the Power, Dissent, and Youth Empowerment event held at the Milwaukee Art Museum this past September. Very passionate story. This is X-Fabula Radio, part of Lake Effect Weekend, every week. Next event coming up on the X-Fabula calendar is on March 7th, Story Slam at Sugar Maple, and the theme is karma. If you have a story that involves karma, you might want to tell it. Well, come on out to this event. All the details you need to know about the upcoming Story Slam on March 7th, you will find at xfabula.org. Our second story today comes from someone of an earlier generation than our first storyteller, but the theme is the same, honoring the past and paving the way to the future. Vera Ford told her story at the Havenwoods Curated Story Slam that was held back in 2011. A bit of an apology here for the audio quality on this one. It is a bit distorted, but it is still worth a listen. Vera Ford.
My name is Vera Ford, and I am the Business Community Liaison at the Milwaukee Job Corps Center. I truly didn't think I had a story to tell until Ms. Brown showed me I had a story to tell. So I'm getting older in age, and I may be telling my age, but one of my favorite television shows is The Golden Girls. And one thing about The Golden Girls, there's one of them that could always tell a story, and that was Sophia. Sophia had a way of telling a story, and she always kind of started it something like this. Picture this, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 2010. Vera's returning to Milwaukee. She's been all over the United States working for Job Corps. And she's come home to roost and retire. But she was told that a brand new center was opening up in Milwaukee. And the president of the company that operated the center asked her if she would maybe come and get the residential component of the center set up. And I agreed, because I really wasn't ready to retire, but I was ready to come home. I had been living in Maine. Once I got back to Milwaukee, I didn't know where the Job Corps Center was located. And so I put on my little tracker to try to figure out where it was. And when I got to the center, and I pulled up at the Welcome Center, and there was a security person there, and she asked who I was. And I told her I was going to be a new employee at the center. And I said, but I don't remember this center being here. And I grew up in Milwaukee, as a matter of fact. I'm one of the first females to go into Job Corps 52 years ago. I am a Job Corps graduate. I said, this used to be a pickle farm. What? It's a Job Corps center now? This pickle farm? So I said, okay, it's a beautiful center. The center I worked up in Maine was a closed military base. So this place looks like a campus. If you haven't come to visit, come visit us, because it looks better than UWM where I graduated from. Okay, so now I'm here. And then I'm getting the residential component set up at Job Corps. And lo and behold, I get a call from a young lady by the name of Jessica. She works for Havenwood. And she's wanted to work at the center and help the students do some gardening. Now, let me just tell you, I grew up in Hillside Projects in Milwaukee. I'm afraid of worms, and I don't do no gardening. And my thought was, these students aren't going to want to do any gardening. Well, I was wrong. Jessica started working with one of our staff members, and her and the students, every week, she was there faithfully working with our young ladies and young men, and they were getting this garden going. And I had to keep scratching my head. I said, this must be a new day, new era, a new Milwaukee, because I know I grew up here and there was no gardens anywhere. If you know Hillside and you've lived in Milwaukee any length of time, concrete jungle, no grass, all concrete. What I can say is my story is, having met Jessica, getting me involved in the community, eventually meeting Stephanie, and loving Miss Liz, I have grown to love Havenwood. I don't live here. I live on 78th and Congress. I'm not far. But I am a member of the Havenwood community. I am Milwaukee. That's one of our slogans at the center. I am Milwaukee, but better than that, I am Havenwood. And so is the Milwaukee Job Corps Center. Like Sophia, I'm getting older and older. But also like Sophia, I've got a lot of spunk. In Havenswood, you got me for a few more years. Use me as you will, because I am now Havenswood. Thank you.
A boy's born in Hot Dive, Mississippi, surrounded by four walls that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city.
Vera Ford, a story told at the Havenwoods Curated Story Slam back in 2011. Today's stories on X-Fabula Radio have featured women who honor the past and prepare for the future as Black History Month comes to a close. The next X-Fabula Story Slam coming up on March 7th at Sugar Maple, and the theme that night is karma. If you have a story that is related to karma and might want to tell it, well, come on down to that event on March 7th. All the details about the Story Slams and other X-Fabula activities are at xfabula.org. If you would like to share today's stories or listen to them again, they are posted at WUWM.com. X-Fabula Radio, part of Lake Effect Weekend, every weekend at this time, Saturday and Sunday. Leah Delaney, get well, won't you? And she should be back next week. I'm Bruce Winter. This is 89.7 WUWM.
X-Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.